Coming today on Breaking Free, a modern divorce podcast.
People are having fewer children, and with that lifestyle change, pets and companion animals are becoming more and more important in people's lives. And so we're seeing increasing numbers of, you know, what I would call custody battles involving your pets or your companion animals.
Welcome to Breaking Free, a modern divorce podcast with Rebecca Zung and Susan Guthrie.
This is the place to hear other people's stories, to learn from the top experts in every related field, and to also have some fun, laugh, and hang with two girlfriends who are also top family law litigators.
And now we invite you to listen to today's show.
It's going to inspire you to transform and break free.
Welcome to today's podcast. Our topic today, bet you didn't know that Fluffy and Fido are furniture and other issues with regard to pets in divorce. I'm Rebecca Zung.
And I'm Susan Guthrie. So today we're talking about pets in divorce, and the statistics are actually pretty impressive. Over 63% of U.S. households have a pet. And that's about 71.1 million people. The vast majority are dog owners. That's about 44 million people. And I thought this one was really spectacular. Americans are expected to spend $41 billion on their pets this year.
Wow. $41
billion with a B.
Wow.
So it was interesting reading about this as we were preparing for the episode, Rebecca, because one of the articles I read posited that one of the reasons why maybe there's an upsurge in seeing issues regarding pets and divorce is that people are having fewer children. And with that lifestyle change, pets and companion animals are becoming more and more important in people's lives. And so we're seeing increasing numbers of, you know, what I would call custody battles involving your pets or your companion animals.
Yeah, I have definitely seen my share of pets and pet issues in divorces myself as well. And it's often like the very first thing that people bring up in divorce or in the initial consultations with me. They'll say, you know, I've got a dog or I've got a cat and I definitely want to keep this dog or cat and it's really, really important to me. And then they start going into all of the reasons why they should be the one to keep it. I'm the only one that takes care of it. He loves me the most. You know, so-and-so, you know, the husband, wife, whatever, is never even home. They never took him to the vet, whatever it is. And so then they start asking me, so how are pets dealt with? And, you know, until very, very recently in a very, very select few states, every state has looked upon pets as just property, hence the title of our show, Fluffy and Fido or Furniture. But, you know, we joke and it sounds horrible, but that's kind of how they were seen or in the middle of a divorce. I mean, it's just the same as the lamp or the living room chair.
Yeah.
And you know, it's hard for people to wrap their head around that, but that is basically how they're looked upon. So, you know, the thing is, when people start looking at what to do with pets, there's really going to be two main things that they're going to be looking at, which are what you just referred to, Susan, as a custody plan.
Yeah.
And then there's also the cost associated with the pets. So, right?
Yeah, no, it's funny because I remember back when I actually got divorced, and that's a long time ago now. I got divorced in 2001. And I remember, and I you know, keep in mind, I was a divorce attorney and at that time. But we had two small dogs and we didn't have children. So, you know, going back to what I said in the beginning, they were, you know, one of the biggest issues in our divorce. And I remember being, you know, again, even as an attorney, pretty shocked to find out that it didn't matter what was best for the dogs in determining who was going to get them. It mattered who owned them, who bought them. And it turned out in our particular case, one had been a gift to me. So that one was going to end up to be mine. And the other one had been purchased by my ex-husband. And, you know, in the end, we came to an agreement on how to share custody of them, how to pass them back and forth between our two households. But when we were in court going over our final agreement, I remember getting to that part of the agreement and the courtroom starting to laugh when we got to the parent sharing plan for the dogs. And I think that's indicative of, you know, it was a new and different thing back then. But we spent a great deal of time talking about when the dogs would be with me, when the dogs would be with him, and how they were going to get between the two households. And then another large chunk of time talking about who was going to pay for all of it. Because as we know today, I know you have a dog, Rebecca, I have three. They are expensive little balls of fluff.
Yes, they are.
So those are, you know, as you just said, the custody plan is one thing to work out, but then there's also, you need to talk about how are the expenses of those animals going to be shared?
Yeah. And, you know, and as you said, it's really definitely better to come up with your own agreement, because the judge is really just going to be left to looking at indicators of who might be more of an owner. You know, you mentioned that you had gotten one of the dogs as a gift. Well, you know, it could have been considered a non-marital gift or a marital gift. I mean, depending on how a judge might look at that. So, and especially if he sat there and said, oh no, you know, Laura gave that dog to both of us and it was a marital gift. Now, you know, what's the judge supposed to do, right? So yeah. They look at what we call indicia of ownership, which is, you know, who paid for it, who took the dog to the vet, whose name might it be registered in, if it's like an AKC registry, or you know, who wrote the check to buy the dog in the first place, whatever it is. And they just kind of look for anything they can grasp on to figure out a solution to go, okay, you know, because the truth of the matter is the judges don't really want to deal with it. I mean, no.
They don't want to argue about your furniture. They don't want to argue about your pets.
I mean, you know, most judges have so many more cases than they can possibly handle. I mean, just to give you an example, in the county where I came from, in Florida, we had three family law judges, but they were really like three half-time family law judges, because the other half of the time they were dealing with, you know, guardianships and juvenile issues or whatever it was. So really 1.5 judges total. And there were 250 new cases filed a month in that county in divorce. And that doesn't even count the divorces that come back with problems with, you know, enforcement and modifications. And those are new cases. So if you can imagine how many hundreds and hundreds of cases are on these judges' dockets, they do not want to deal with your pet problem. Right. I mean, you know, it's like they're just going to come up with the quickest thing they can possibly come up with and be off, and it'll be off their desk.
Right. Well, so, and remember, usually, right, Rebecca, all the judge needs to decide is who the owner is, and that kind of ends the issue. The owner gets the dog, and the owner's responsible for the cost of the dog. So for a judge, if they can make a determination as to who the owner of the dog is, that ends most of the issue. The judges are not usually going to work out a custody plan or a cost sharing plan.
Yeah. And that's really kind of not fair either, because a lot of times it has nothing to do with who owned the dog or not. Right. I mean, sometimes it's other reasons why somebody says that they want the dog, you know?
Yeah. Well, and a lot of times you do have that case in a marriage where the two go off to the local animal shelter together and pick out a dog, but one of them happens to write the check. Does that make that one the owner of the dog or the cat or the animal? You know, these two, and then they share the taking care. It's really their joint pet. What does a judge do in those cases?
You know, they're, well, and what I'm... thinking though too is like, what if the person who wrote the check doesn't even really want the dog, but knows that the other one does?
Oh yeah. You know, just, this is like those cases, you know, where the dog is a weapon or the pet is a weapon against the other party. It's not that I want the dog. It's that I don't want you to have the dog.
Yeah. It comes down to being a control issue, a way to hurt the other person. Right. So, I mean, it can be a very, very expensive proposition, not just the cost of the pet themselves, but also the litigation can be extremely expensive.
Oh, yeah. I mean, just getting into a courtroom and putting on the evidence of the indicia of ownership that you talked about, often those are not cut and dried, right? I mean, one of them may have paid for the pet, but the other one may be the one who took the pet to the vet all of the time. And so you don't often have a very, you know, very black and white situation. So you can spend quite a bit of time in court in a hearing just putting on the evidence around the indicia of ownership, hoping that the scales are going to tip into your client's favor.
Yeah, look, there's pictures of me with Fluffy and none with you.
Fluffy likes me best. Yeah, I've spent all of the time with Fluffy. And that's, you know, that's not uncommon in relationships. I mean, if you have a situation where one party is more available during the day to be the one to take the child, or the dog, the dog to the vet or the cat to the groomer or whatever that is, you may have one of the people who interacted with the animal more often. But does that mean that the other party who was at work or traveling or whatever they were doing, that they were there less, any less the owner of that pet?
Yeah, I know. I mean, I know that you can negotiate some extremely elaborate plans. So what are some samples of pet custody arrangements that you've seen?
You know, we've come up with, you know, just like you do with child parenting schedules, a lot of the time I've seen schedules that that go to exactly what I was just talking about, what the availability of the two owners is to have the pet with them. I know when I worked out my personal pet sharing plan, they would be with my ex-husband when he was in town, but he traveled quite a bit for business. So the agreement was simply that if he was in town, the dogs were with him. And if he was traveling for business, the dogs were with me. And so I've seen people do that. I've seen cases where the parties decide that the pets really belong with the kids. And so the pet will travel back and forth between the households as the children pass between mom and dad's or dad and dad's and mom's house.
Yeah, I've seen that too. And the thing about that, though, is that then what happens if you decide to pick the kids up at school or at summer camp or something? That now you got to go figure out a way to go get the dog as well. It just doesn't really end up being all that feasible.
It's often not practical, you know, and sometimes one of the parents doesn't have a household that's well suited to an animal. Or again, you just get that situation where they don't have the time to be, you know, the one walking the dog or making the arrangements. And it can be expensive because if that person is not available during the day to say, take the dog out, now you need a pet walker or someone to.
And who's supposed to pay for that?
And that's another argument.
It's a pro rata split.
I've had that. Yeah.
So I mean, a pro rata split would be a reference to a child support where you actually take both parties' incomes and you come up with a ratio of what each party's income is to each other. So it might be, you know, you make 60% of the income, you pay 60% of the expenses. And we often see that in child support where people break down uncovered medical expenses or extracurriculars or, oh, speaking of.
I know.
Somebody
one of my pets is wandering around in the back.
you know, that would be a pro rata split. And I've seen people actually do some sort of a percentage breakdown of expenses. And I've actually had to litigate enforcement of that. Because what happens is, even though there's really no laws around pets like this, no custody laws, no child support laws around pets, if you contract for it, once you agree to it, sign your name on the dotted line, and it becomes part of the final judgment, then it is an enforceable contract. Then it is something that the judge can force you to do. And so what I've had to litigate is where people end up having thousands of dollars in expenses that piled up over the pets, and they have an agreement that says that the other person is supposed to reimburse, and then the other person doesn't. So, you know, in that situation, I definitely recommend that you have some sort of language that says, you know, you have 30 days to present the receipts, and then the other person has 30 days from the time of presentation of the receipts to reimburse. Because if you don't have enforcement language in there like that, it's really hard for the judge to enforce. I mean, especially if somebody waits 3 years and then hands the other person a bill for $5,000 and says, here's the last 3 years of bills, pay up, you know.
I've seen those cases where people, you know, sort of let it ride for a good long time, present $8,000 in expenses that are supposed to be reimbursed, and then get upset when the other party says, you know, I don't have that money right this second.
Coming up, more from Susan and Rebecca on Bet You Didn't Know That Fluffy and Fido Are Furniture, and other issues with pets in divorce.
We all remember the Leona Helmsley case where she left her entire estate to her dog, basically. And that's
a little dog.
Yeah, it's not uncommon.
Take a listen to our episode archive, where you can hear Rebecca and Susan discuss more topics on divorce in depth, including Thriving Through Gray Divorce with Sue Ferreira, creator of From Wisdom to Wealth Mastery.
So what advice would you give women who are facing gray divorce?
I would say, somewhere deep in your soul, there's a niggle, right? There's something that you always long to do. And just bring that to the fore. Give yourself a new purpose in life and start moving forward. Because you're going forward anyway, so you may as well move forward with purpose. And that would be my advice.
And now we return to today's show.
Have you seen, I've had the situation though where the parties have agreed to share pet expenses that they agree upon. And then it will come down to a situation where one of the pets has a critical illness or an injury where I just had one of my pets needed knee surgery, and that was, you know, $4,000. And I had a case where that came up and one of the parties thought it was perfectly reasonable to spend that money and the other party didn't. And so they ended up going to court arguing over whether or not it was reasonable or not to spend $4,000 to have knee surgery for their dog.
Yeah. I mean, there's like language you can throw in there, like reasonable and necessary and discussed and agreed upon and things like that. Right. And that all sounds really great when it comes down to real life, we've discussed it and I don't agree. I don't think it's reasonable and necessary because, you know, it's a pet and it's not a child. And so I don't really want to pay it or whatever it is. And so then it's going to be up to a judge to try to interpret the contract.
Yeah.
And it's
well, if you even decide to take it to a judge, because often the expense of enforcement or just trying to litigate it, many of our laws have, provisions for the allowance of attorney's fees on motions, for contempt or to compel, abiding by an agreement. But I certainly have never seen them covered 100%. the council fees or the costs almost or rarely.
Yeah, I mean, it just depends. I mean, I think if you are going back to enforce, I mean, I've seen there in Florida, there's language, one of the cases that actually says that if there's language in the agreement that says, you know, if any either party has to come back and enforce this agreement, then the person who caused the problem will have to pay both sides' fees. Well, sometimes the judges enforce that and sometimes they don't. But where I see them enforcing it much more readily is when it comes to failure to pay child support and alimony. When it comes to contractual obligations, they tend to be a little bit more mishy-mashy.
It comes down to the fact that sometimes these clauses can be a little open to interpretation, like you and I just were talking about, is what's reasonable and necessary as an expense for your animal. What the parties can have different interpretations of what's reasonable and necessary. And if there is a reasonable dispute over that interpretation, it's not very common that you get a judge awarding counsel fees for taking that to court.
Yeah, for sure. So one of the things that the parties could agree on is bearing the expense together of an insurance premium. There are pet insurance policies available now, which cover a certain number of things. And that may be a way to kind of protect both parties from major unexpected expenses.
Medical expenses, sure. You know, I've been seeing that a lot more often. I've had a few mediations recently where the pet and the pet expenses were an issue. It was interesting. It was not who the pet was going to belong to or who the pet was going to reside with. That was determined in these cases lately. But the question of the expenses has definitely been there because pets have become increasingly expensive. And in most of the cases, another thing people are looking at is setting a monthly contribution that the other pet parent will be responsible for, a certain monetary amount per month that they contribute toward food, vet, you know, whatever expenses there might be. And then the parent who or pet parent who has the pet is responsible for anything over and above that. And that has actually, I think in my last three or four mediated cases, been the resolution on the pet expense issue.
Well, I think that's a good idea. I mean, these pets can be very, very near and dear to people's hearts. We all remember the Leona Helmsley case where she left her entire estate to her dog, basically. So that's
lucky little dog.
Yeah, it's not uncommon. And I think you had mentioned to me the other day that there are some new state laws. Do you want to tell our listeners a little bit about that?
Yeah, I was interested to find out. So, you know, we talked about the fact that really the law has for a long time been established that pets are personal property. But recently in 2017, Alaska and Illinois both passed laws that allow the judge to take the animal's best interests into consideration in making orders about where the pet will live, who the pet will live with, and how their expenses will be shared, which really is a quantum shift from treating them like a piece of furniture, like we've referenced here. So now a judge can take in those two states, and I think there are a couple other states with legislation pending that might pass about this, but it's really now allows a judge to have some discretion in looking at, you know, what might be best for the dog or the cat or the companion animal in fashioning these orders. And it gives the judge some capability of making orders financially, maybe that the parties didn't agree to. You know, what we've been talking about up to now is where the parties agree on how they're going to share those expenses. And in the past, judges didn't have an ability to apportion expenses among the parties. In those two states, they now do.
Well, you know, what strikes me about that, though, is if somebody decides that they want to have a prenuptial agreement or even a postnuptial agreement with regard to the pets and say, you know, let's just say you write it out and say, hey, if we ever get divorced, you know, here's going to be the schedule for Fluffy or Fido. And what is interesting to me, when you introduce a best interest analysis, I'm curious to know if that's going to play out the same as it does in a best interest analysis for children. Because in a prenuptial agreement or a postnuptial agreement around children, they're not necessarily enforceable because the court always has the final authority in determining what is the best interest of the child. And parents may not necessarily come up with a parenting plan that is in the best interest of the child. I mean, most of the time the courts ratify the parents' agreement, but sometimes they don't. And so I'm curious to see how this ends up playing out as to whether or not this would mean that prenuptial agreements or other written agreements with regard to pets would not necessarily end up being enforceable in light of the best interest analysis.
I guess we'll see. Yeah, that will add a kicker to that question. So although it opens the door for judges to have more ability to fashion something that's better for the pet in those states, you're absolutely right. And it brings to question also if a judge makes a determination, as they do in a case with children, as to what's in the children's best interest at the time of the decision. We know that that's always modifiable in the future if there's a change in the circumstances so that the best interests are different. So do you have that situation where if you have a visitation plan or a parenting plan in place for your pet, for Fido and Fluffy, and then something changes, one of you moves or further
substantial
away.
Change in circumstances,
right? So now are you going back to court over and over again to modify those orders, and the judge will have to do a new best interest analysis each time you go back to court. So I think that may have been one of the reasons why it has so many jurisdictions have been resistant to treating companion animals as sentient beings, as if they were children, as opposed to just pieces of furniture. It's easier to treat them as pieces of furniture legally.
So you had told me the other day about, I think it's kind of a humorous example of what a judge decided to do. This particular judge got very creative and did the Johnny Cochran of...
Yeah. Okay.
So,
courtroom. I remember in law school, they always said, "Don't do a trial run of anything in the courtroom unless you know exactly what's going to happen, because that will always come back to bite you." But this judge obviously didn't care about that, because it was a pet dispute, and I just remember hearing about this case. And the judge, both parties felt that the dog. It was their dog, and that the dog, they were clearly the one who had spent the most time with the dog, and the dog loved them. And the judge finally decided to let the dog testify by having the dog brought into the courtroom. Both of the parties stood at opposite ends of the courtroom, and they each called the dog at the same time. And the one that the dog went to got the dog.
Oh my gosh. So, you know, if the dog doesn't come, you must succumb.
Yeah. Ownership. Yeah. Exactly. The OJ trial of pet.
Yes.
But that was that judge's deterrent. You know, he felt like evidence between coming from both of the parties, he couldn't make up his mind. So I guess the dog can't testify in court except through a demonstration. So it worked for the wife in that case, by the way. The dog ran.
I'm pretty sure my dog would come to me too. Yeah. I don't know. My husband may disagree.
Mine are all circling around me as we speak. So I like to think.
So prenups, I think, would definitely help. And, you know, we've also seen, you know, other factors like, you know, getting a vet opinion, almost like a custody evaluation, right?
Yeah. I was especially in my reading, I haven't personally had that case where we brought the vet in to testify or make an expert opinion as to where the best placement of the pet would be. But I read about cases online where people have done that, I thought about that, and I thought, well, if one of the parties is the one who usually brings the dog to the vet, wouldn't the vet have, you know, much more experience and no experience of how the pet is with the other parent? So I don't know if that's the most valuable thing, but I read about a couple of cases where the vet did testify.
That's really interesting. You know, I'm sure they're looking at the relationship between the kids and the dog as well, and work schedules, right?
Yeah. Well, that's like my case, right? You know,
yeah.
You just work the whole thing right around on who was available to be with. It's the same thing, you know, often when I sit down to fashion a parenting plan for the children with the parents, the first place you start is, when are you available to parent? If you're in traveling to Singapore once a month and you're gone for a week or two at a time, maybe that's not the time that you're available. So it's the same thing with a pet. If you're gone from 6 a.m. traveling into the city or whatever to go to work, maybe, you know, the dog's not best placed or the cat's not best placed with you during the day, depending.
Yeah, but I don't want you to have him. I'll put him in a kennel.
And I think that's actually a huge part. You know, some of these litigated cases around the pets, I read about one case and I just thought this was crazy. In 2000, there was a case where these two people fought over their greyhound Gigi for 2 years, and they spent between them over $150,000, and that's dedicated to the dispute over Gigi. So you have to believe.
You can have your own whole fleet of greyhounds with that amount of money.
You can get the bus for that amount of money.
You could, you know, buy a farm and have greyhounds on it.
Yeah, think of the rescue work you could
do. Wow.
You know, you have to believe in those cases to a certain degree. There's something maybe a little bit more than.
Yeah, it's I don't want you to win. That's what it is. You know, remember my whole speech about divorce law versus divorce justice, you know?
Yeah.
I want my version of justice, which is you suffer.
Right. And certainly, you know, our companion animals are a source of comfort to us. When I had my practice in Connecticut, one of my dogs would often come to my office with me. And when I'd have a client who was upset in the office, he just seemed to know that it was a good time to nose his way into the conference room. And he would sit in people's laps and just sit there and let them pet him. But he had a remarkable effect. I got to the point where certain clients were just like, where is Sailor? I want to, you know, can I get Sailor? And I think that during a divorce, especially when it's such an upsetting time for people to go and try to take away that source of comfort from one of the people, or maybe it's the pet is a source of comfort to both of them, but maybe that's another reason why it's so emotional, because there's already such heightened emotion. And now one of our few comforts during that time or during any trying time is our pet. And one of the parties is trying to take that away from the other. I always would tell clients, you know, you can spend $150,000 arguing over who gets to keep your pet, but in the end, you're so much better off trying to just come up with a way to share your pet.
Yeah, definitely. I mean, especially in light of the statistic that divorce is one of the most common reasons people end up giving up their dogs and they end up in shelters. So, you know, definitely mediation is the way to go.
Oh, absolutely. Yeah, I mentioned to you, I have a friend who's a mediator, and her entire practice is dedicated solely to mediating disputes around pets, around animals and pets.
Amazing. So
that's not just, you know, custody battles like we're talking about. She does vet stuff too. Her name's Deborah Hamilton in New York, but she, you know, that's, I think, an indicator that she can have a practice solely dedicated to helping people resolve these disputes is a sign of just how contentious it can get around our companion animals.
Yeah, so Fluffy and Fido are definitely not furniture,
no.
But we have to make sure we figure out a way to protect them. So,
yeah. So just remember, treat them like people too, and don't let them be casualties of your divorce.
Absolutely.
Thank you for joining us today on Breaking Free, a Modern Divorce Podcast. I'm Rebecca Zung.
And I'm Susan Guthrie.
For a limited time, get your free copy of Rebecca's best-selling divorce book, Breaking Free, a step-by-step divorce guide to achieving emotional, physical, and spiritual freedom at www.breakingfreethebook.com.
And for your free copy of Susan's Top 10 Reasons to Mediate Your Divorce, visit www.divorceinabetterway.com.
Check back next Monday for our next edition of our powerful, inspirational, and educational podcast. And if you enjoyed today's podcast, please remember to give us a 5-star rating on iTunes and let us know what you liked in a review.
And remember, you're just one step away from your new life.